count for two. Get it off cleanly. Blitz comes. He's flushed and looking and scrambling and leaping. It is in! Wow! Clayton Tune up, up and away. End zone. Got Dell again. His third of the night. This guy is a touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes!
Welcome to the Scott Nolan Podcast. We are back for the first time in 2022, recapping a Houston Cougar football game. And wow, what a game it was between the Cougs and the UTSA Roadrunners as we sit now just over 24 hours after the conclusion of this one. I'm not sure my heart rate is back to normal after that. Even in a week one college football slate where I feel like there were several high entertainment value games, I don't think I'm showing any Cougar biases in saying here at the top that this was the wildest and most entertaining game on the entire week one slate, in my humble opinion. But showing my own Cougar biases, I'm sure it didn't hurt my enjoyment of this one that it ended up being a very crazy, but still a very much Cougar win. Dustin, you were there in person at the Alamo Dome for this absolute classic of a season opener. How was that, bud?
Man, it was a wild experience. You are right in terms of the effect that it had on a lot of people's heart rates, certainly mine included. Lots of moments in that game when kind of felt your heart jumping into the throat. I was excited to be there with my fellow Cougar fans. It feels good to you know, that's part of college football season, is getting to go to the games and experience, soak in that atmosphere with your fellow Cougs, and was lucky to snag some tickets right in the middle of the Cougar section. And yeah, it was a great time, and obviously it was a lot of heartburn to go with a lot of moments of ecstasy as well. But on the whole, just, you know, battle of a couple of 12 win teams from last year, you got to be happy coming away with a W, no matter how you get it, no matter how dramatic it is. I think that was, I'm amazed we didn't actually use this in the episode description leading up to it, but it was definitely one of those, you take any win you could get it by even 1 point, and even in triple overtime, you're certainly happy just to get the road win.
I feel like at some point during the offseason, but certainly not in the episode, which is, it's funny, it's kind of a conspicuous absence of one of us not saying like, oh, we take a 1 point win, but absolutely, we would have both taken a 1 point win. So I guess logic dictates to us, and I always make this joke, but logic dictates we should be twice as grateful as if it was a 1 point win with this 2 point margin. But before we talk about that extremely memorable game in detail, I wanted to mention at the top, we are proud members of the 1012 Network. Follow them on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Listen to 1012 Pod. They had a great week one preview episode I listened on my commute Friday. Keep up on your future conference, Cougars, because before we know it, we will all be members of a power conference of the Big 12, which we are very excited about here. And of course, we're also brought to you by the good folks at the good brand, Homefield Apparel, homefieldapparel.com. Promo code HOLMAN12. You just type that in, Holman12, like Scott and Holman, at checkout. Get 15% off your first order. An incredible, recently refreshed Cougar collection, multiple awesome Sailor Cougar designs, a great collection of schools outside of the University of Houston, hundreds of different schools from the Blues to the Blue Bloods to Division II and Division III schools, just premium quality, incredibly comfortable t-shirts all around. That's homefieldapparel.com, promo code HOLMAN12. Support Homefield and support the podcast here in the process. So, Dustin, let's not wait any further. Let's get to what everyone that's tuning this pod wants to hear us talk about, the triple overtime 37-35 win by your Houston Cougars over the UTSA Roadrunners. And we're going to start this out. We're going to kind of try and format our thoughts in, you know, any episode recaps of football season this year this way. Talk about how the game was won specifically for three quarters, Dustin, and not that there's not plenty of red meat to talk about in those three quarters. For three quarters, this was a pretty low scoring, I'm not even just saying it because my team played particularly poorly in those three quarters, not a game really high on the excitement. There's a big play here or there, but it was a very frustrating game for the first three quarters. And I think that frustration for the Cougar fan base certainly culminated in UTSA taking a 21-7 lead courtesy of a DeCorian Clark touchdown reception from Frank Harris just over 4 minutes left, less than 20 minutes in the ballgame. Dustin was looking kind of hopeless at that point. Honestly, I may or may not have texted a real-life friend of the show, Bobby, and said, you know, if we don't score in this touchdown drive, I might start mentally making my plans for the rest of this afternoon and evening. It was looking very bleak, but next possession, Cougars go 75 yards, culminating in Tank Dell's second touchdown reception of the day, cuts the Roadrunner lead back to one score. And I think maybe the inflection point of this game, in my opinion, the next UTSA possession, and there are many inflection points in this game, but I would argue none greater than this one. Cougar defense gets a much-needed turnover. Nelson Caesar intercepts a tipped pass, takes it down to the UTSA 20-yard line, and all the Cougar offense needed was one play from there. Clayton Toon finds Joseph Manjack the fourth in the back of the end zone with a one-handed grab that I can tell you it was really freaking awesome. I can tell you it was an incredible one-handed catch, but what would probably be the best endorsement is that it was the SportsCenter number one play this past morning from the first Saturday of college football. It was the SportsCenter number one and worth every bit of that accolade. So Cougars tie the ball game at this point. UTSA gets to start midfield thanks to a kick out of bounds by the Cougs, but they stall out in Cougar territory. Cougs get the ball at their own 5-yard line, 18 play, 70-yard drive. Cougs tie it, 23 seconds left. You know, I'm just about celebrating. I'm really at this point just convinced we did it. We came back. And of course, nothing came easy in this game. UTSA, no timeouts, 23 seconds, still gets two completions for 55 yards, sets up a Jared Sackett 37-yard field goal. And Dustin, we go to overtime. And honestly, at the time, feels kind of deflating.
No, it definitely did. I think the game felt won, and I think everyone with that big of a lead. But you know, credit to Houston for not falling apart and losing their momentum or losing their composure, seeing the game go to overtime. You know, kind of an interesting thing. You are unlikely to see. I don't think I'd ever seen it before or ever seen it again. You saw Houston win the coin toss in overtime, and then take the ball first instead of going on defense first, which you just never see. I kind of see where Dana Holgorsen was coming from with that, in the sense of, you know, the Houston offense had just been on the field for that incredible, you know, like 10 plus minute drive, and you figured UTSA's defense was worn out from that, and you want to get UTSA's defense right back out on the field and go against them when they're good and tired. But, you know, the rule says if you don't, you, it's the same as like the coin toss before the game, where if you can choose which end of the field, and you think, if anything, okay, then you at least choose to play the first overtime in the end of the field where there are some Houston fans down in that end zone, instead of the one where just going into what looked like a student section for UTSA, just some of the rowdiest fans in the entire stadium. So Houston ended up getting both negative, both negatives, and they were going into the end you wouldn't want to go into, and they had, you know, went first and gave UTSA the chance to see what they needed to do to match them. So, you know, all's well that ends well, but definitely it's a decision that I think would have led to a lot more consternation.
Questioning.
Among you and us, had it not ended in a victory.
It would be a fair question to ask. It would have been a fair question to come on here and ask if they had come to fruition like that. Again, all's well, all's well. But yeah, it would have been curious. Curious is the right adjective for that.
For sure. But, you know, the teams trade field goals. And then the second overtime, you got to go for two. The Cougars strike first, get the touchdown, get the two-point conversion. Again, look at things looking pretty good, only for UTSA to come right back and match them with the touchdown and the 2-point conversion. And then the third overtime, not to get on too much of a soapbox here talking about the game, but I'm glad Houston won, so I cannot sound as bitter when I talk about this, but just third overtime already going to the 2-point conversion shootout thing is the dumbest rule, and I hate it. And at least let them go like 3 or 4. Actually, you know, going right to the mandatory 2-point conversions after the second overtime, fine, but like, the 2-point conversion shootout, it just feels very cheesy and not the way you want to decide a game. But I'm glad it ended out okay. But then,
a penalty kick shootout equivalent for
exactly.
Football.
Exactly. It's just, But, and again, I don't want to complain about it too much, because the end result of that being the rule was that we got, you know, and we're only 1 week into football season, but what I think we can already say is going to go down as one of the plays of the year for Cougar Athletics as a whole for the 2022-2023 season. And that is Clayton Toon, after yet another false start penalty, which it looked like was going to just be the absolute, you know, Achilles heel for Houston. This one was just the repeated false start penalties, give Houston that 2-point conversion attempt from the 7 or the 8 yard line, whatever it is. And Clayton Toon, you know, getting flushed out of the pocket, making the pylon, and just from about 3 yards out going airborne, getting flipped, and then, you know, landing in the end zone for the 2-point conversion. And then, you know, one of the big factors coming down the stretch too is Houston's defense finally, you know, in the fourth quarter and onwards, finally getting some pressure on Frank Harris, making him uncomfortable in the pocket, which they'd not been able to do for much of the game. And, you know, on the ensuing two-point conversion, they got pressure on Frank Harris, made him throw the ball somewhere that he didn't want to, where there was no one really there, and the ball, you know, fell harmlessly to the turf, and the Cougars got away with a three-overtime, 37-35 victory over the UTSA Roadrunners. So it was definitely, you know, one of the more stressful games that you're likely to see. The Cardiac Cougs certainly coming up big there. But, you know, all in all, anytime you beat a good team coming off a 12-win season and returning a lot of players from a 12-win team last year on the road, you know, like you said, you're happy with a victory of any margin, and certainly one that was well-earned by the Cougs. And against the UTSA team that we should play, you know, we should say, I thought, played extremely well.
Agreed. And I think when we kind of get into the more of the minutiae of this game, there's definitely plenty of red meat in terms of things you can criticize about the Cougar offensive effort. But I think the good news, and I think the reason I'm not panicking too much as we sit here on Sunday evening, is that I think you could direct very little of that criticism towards Clayton Tune. Not, I would say, ideal ball security in that first half fumble that gave UTSA the ball around midfield. But, you know, I really scanned through that game mentally, and I rewatched this in large parts, and you know, watched it live, obviously, and rewatched it between the end of the game and now. I didn't really, you know, I didn't see him, you know, throwing a lot of interceptable balls. It felt like every ball he threw, either like his guy had the best chance to get it or nobody had the best chance to get it, which I think is about some of the best, I guess, praise you could give a receiver. And he had like four or five passes, I would say, just my count, that went off a receiver's hands or were at least certainly catchable passes for a Division I receiver that weren't brought in. And he handled a lot of pressure. He dealt with a lot of, I would say, subpar pass blocking in front of him at times on Saturday. And I thought the offense used him periodically in good spots on clearly designed runs. But I think most of that, you know, in the run game was just him, you know, things breaking down, guys not getting open, and him just making things happen with his feet. And, you know, with the previous exception of that fumble, I thought just secured the ball quite well while not being given ideal protection by his offensive line. That's what made, you know, to go back 12 months ago, that's what made last year's opener at the time so worrisome, because, you know, you're talking at that moment, you know, hypothetically, is, you know, if Clayton Tune wasn't the right guy, it didn't matter how much better you were in all other aspects of your offense. And this time, it's the opposite. The good news is Clayton Tune looks every bit the, you know, fifth year senior Clayton Tune we were hoping for. You know, I, again, can't remember a pass where he didn't put the ball where his guy gets you or nobody could, and just, I think, did everything that you would want a multi-year starting quarterback to, you know, positively affect the game to do. I think, again, a lot of criticism you can lob generally towards the Cougar offense and Cougar offense's game plan, et cetera, but I don't think you can direct very much of it, Clayton, too. I thought he was pretty outstanding in a very pressure-packed game situation.
Yeah, I thought maybe one or two of his first half sacks, he maybe could have gotten the ball, you know, out or thrown away or eluded, you know. But other than that, I think I agree with you that pretty much every throw he put it on the money, and you know, made a lot of really impressive plays, especially with his feet, and really, you know, as the game went on, you know, I thought got a lot better at stepping up in the pressure, and, you know, and stepping up in the pocket, and obviously, you know, made the play of the game with his feet. So certainly, you know, was having a lot of success there. And that's something that, you know, last year we saw him, you know, he got dinged up a little bit early on in the season, and then the rest of the year, you know, looking good as a passer, but not showing the mobility that we kind of knew from past seasons that he was capable of. And that was one of the things that was exciting for me, was having him look a lot healthier in this game, and making plays with his feet, and just, you know, showing that in addition to being a really, really good passer, who, like you said, you know, consistently puts the ball where only his receivers can catch it, is someone that can make plays with his feet as well. And that's why he's, you know, I think in all conference caliber quarterback and has that potential is, you know, because he feels like both of those aspects of his game are there, in addition to kind of the intangibles, the toughness and the leadership that you want from a quarterback. You know, so like I said, certainly there's some criticism there. You know, I think for much of the game, we didn't see the, you know, the vertical passing offense that we were kind of promised over, you know, that we heard a lot of talk over the offseason about how the big difference from last year's offense to this one was going to be, you know, the vertical passing game, and the fact that despite we're talking about Clayton Tune having a pretty solid game, he's a game where he had, you know, less than 6.5 yards per pass attempt is not a number that you want to see him keep having for the rest of the year. But, you know, that did include, like you said, some drops, but included some spectacular catches. You know, Matthew Golden on the sideline, Joseph Manjack at the back of the end zone, some of the spectacular catches that went with some of the unfortunate easy drops as
not
well.
A completion also. He had a nice deep ball that drew a PI by UTSA, I think intended for Matthew Golden.
Yeah. But, you know, I was really happy for Clayton Tune on the whole, and kind of like you talked about with last year, I think the symmetry of last year of, A game where Houston and Clayton Toon looked pretty strong early on, and then the wheels really fell off in the second half to kind of have the opposite this year in the opener where, Houston didn't start out looking the strongest, but just really came on and got stronger and stronger down the stretch and ended up winning the game in overtime and kind of snatching victory from the jaws of defeat as opposed to maybe doing a little bit of the opposite in last year's season opener.
Yeah, got to mention the drops. It was not ideal. I'd like to ascribe at least some of that to first game jitters. We should remember that pretty much every receiver not named Tank Dell or Keshawn Carter was playing, I guess if you include the Titans, Christian Train as well, but playing their first game with the Cougars. I think Golden will be fine for good measure, had the longest reception of any Cougar offensive player. I believe you just mentioned that. That protection was bad too. I think while we're on the negatives here, four sacks allowed against an opponent who lost their best individual pass rusher, and I think was, accurate statement would be, was retooling at least somewhat on the defensive front. Maybe a bit early, but still a bit of a red flag. That's four sacks allowed to 32 pass attempts, and the run blocking wasn't much better. I'd argue maybe it was even worse. I have my opinions on how much U of H should have run the ball in this one versus how much they actually did, but I would say regardless, it felt like it was very much the exception to the rule when a U of H back had anything close to a decent size hole to run through. I mean, your three running backs, Henry, Snead, and Campbell combined for 89 net rushing yards and 29 carries. That's not going to really be good enough on a week in, week out basis if this is a team that seriously aspires to be a conference champion, New Year's Six Bowl kind of team. And it's not really a criticism of the young guys, Snead and Campbell. I think both of those guys were certainly seeing their first extended, really meaningful Division I action on Saturday. And it behooves your line to put your young backs in a bit better position to succeed. I think that was maybe the thing that was most frustrating to me, besides the game plan aspect of which I'm sure we'll get to. Just it felt like we were trying to be a run first team with one of the better quarterback receiver combos in the country. It felt sometimes just like, do you know the personnel of your team? Do you know why are you running between the tackles with a redshirt freshman running back when you have Clayton Toon and Tank Dell? And I will end this by saying I don't think it's a coincidence that when U of H had to go pass first in the final quarter and some change, that they had three scoring drives versus the and I know one of the scoring drives is set up on the opponent's 20, but that you were able to get into the end zone very quickly in a situation where you needed to get quickly. That's why you got so much better on offense, that you stopped trying to make a run game that wasn't working work. And that was maybe my biggest frustration about Saturday's game specifically.
Yeah, I think it was a little concerning that none of the four rushers, the three running backs, or Clayton Toon, none of those four guys even individually averaged 3.5 yards a carry, let alone, doing that as a team. And the sacks, like you mentioned, especially early on, and Dana Holgorsen pulled no punches in this, post-game press conference. I think he said something to the extent of the offensive line was pretty bad for three quarters, and then I yelled at them, and then they did pretty good down the stretch. Hopefully maybe yell at them before the Texas Tech game, hopefully, and get that kind of performance for four quarters would be nice, because I think that's one of your biggest, I think, concerns coming away. I agree, is against a UTSA, defensive front that was, like I said, missing their biggest guy. For the first three quarters, a lot of pressure and on Clayton Toon, and not a lot of running success. And I think certainly with the way that game played out, gives Dana Holgorsen and Shannon Dawson something to think about in terms of the way that they, call plays going forward. In fact, at one point early on, I think I saw where in Houston had been, struggling offensively, is like they had run on first down like 7 out of 10 times or something like that, and just, weren't having a ton of success with that. And even when, some of the late possessions, Houston was still running the ball. They didn't stop running the ball. Dana Holgorsen is not going to stop. He's not going to throw the ball 75% of the time. I don't think he should do that. But, I think what we saw late was that Houston started throwing the ball right off the bats, right? They established drives. They got drives going by putting the ball in the air. And then once they did that, they ran off of the pass instead of trying to force the pass to happen so that they could, pass off of the run. They let the pass happen first instead of trying to make a run game that just wasn't there, tried to make that happen. So I think that's something that, they may have to consider. Maybe you go out versus Texas Tech and if you're scheduling your first opening possession, have four of your first five plays, start chucking it around the yard a little bit, start trying to, get a little bit more of that. And obviously you have to have the offensive line protecting the quarterback the way that you want them to do that. But, maybe take a couple of deep shots down the field early on and just give the other team something to think about in terms of the pass game. And then, and then use the run game, you know, when they're already thinking about the pass. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they kind of strategize that going forward into the Texas Tech game. But, you know, the fact that, you know, at one point it was late third quarter and, you know, I was just rewatching the game right before we came on here, and, you know, having watched it at the stadium, didn't have some of the stats that they had on the TV. See, though, yeah, late in the third quarter when Frank Harris had 290 yards of total offense.
They had like half that as a team. Yeah, that's right. I remember that
it's
one.
Like, oh, that's not great, man. And that's, you know, I'm glad everything came together down the stretch, but certainly going into week two, you're trying to think of how do we have more than 127 yards of total offense, you know, 5 minutes left in the third quarter, whatever it was.
Yeah, I was just going to say, not a coincidence, one of my favorite stats. Tune attempted nearly half of his passes, 15 of 32 specifically, on U of H's last three drives of regulation. Again, don't think it's coincidence. The Cougs scored three times after managing only one scoring drive in their first eight prior to that. And I think the other concerning thing, though I would say I'm less concerned about this than what we just got done talking about, is that collectively the Cougs had six false start penalties in San Antonio, Dustin, five of which came from the offensive line. And, you know, six false starts is less impactful than, you know, I guess six pass interferences or six holdings, at least. You know, you're talking just from a raw yardage perspective alone. And I could tell just from watching on TV how loud that UTSA crowd was, the Alamo Dome. I mean, you were there. I'm going to lean on you for this one, Dustin, not watching on TV. Was this the kind of just absurd volume that, you know, you're there and you're like, okay, well, it's annoying, but I kind of get why guys are flinching or jumping at the wrong times. I'm genuinely curious.
No, I mean it was a loud, electric atmosphere. I'm not going to take that away from UTSA or pretend like it wasn't. And it was, and you know, and I'm glad that you mentioned it, because I think it's important to give a shout out to the Cougar fans that traveled. It was reportedly like 8,000 Cougar fans that made the
broadcast, yeah,
that made the trip. And you know, I wasn't sure, you know, if and that was kind of another thing from rewatching the game on the TV feed. I was like, man, I felt like, and I was in the middle of the U of H section, so it felt like we were making a lot of noise. But you could hear on the TV too, like it was. You know, the Alamo Dome was rocking when U of H would make a good play. So the 8,000 Cougar fans that showed up certainly represented themselves well, and I thought made a lot of impact and made a lot of noise there. But you know, and certainly you give the UTSA fans some credit for some of those false starts. But you know, I think that you know, you got to throw some you know, game one jitters in there as well, and certainly I think even with all that factored in, you'd think I imagine that the U of H coaching staff is hoping to see a little bit better composure from the offensive line when they go to Lubbock for week two.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's out of the frying pan into the fire, man. It's not gonna get any easier in terms of crowd noise in week two, even if the dome atmosphere is kind of its own unique animal. Yeah, I guess we should talk about the Cougar defense too, and this isn't in any way me saying the Cougar defense had a perfect or clean game on Saturday, but I also don't think I saw anything that really, really surprised me from the Cougar defense against this opponent. I mean, broadly, the tackling wasn't the best. I thought Frank Harris in particular really made the Cougars pay there. He extended a lot of plays, really was the only guy giving UTSA anything consistently positive in the run game. That second quarter, 38-yard touchdown run probably being one of UTSA's biggest highlights from Saturday. I will think it's worth pointing out here, though, you know, for anyone saying that this maybe wasn't the best game from the Cougar defensive front, UTSA's running backs, Traylon Smith and Breelon Brady, combined for 45 net rushing yards on 19 carries. That's good. And I think it really helped down the stretch, because really, and I think you saw the Cougars start to get, you know, in the, you know, latter parts, you know, the third and fourth quarter, the overtime, some pressure on Frank Harris. I think that's because UTSA really just had to abandon anything other than an improvised quarterback run. They really, I think something I mentioned when we went on with our friends at the Alamo Dome Audible was, if UTSA could get, you know, 3 to 5 yards consistently, nothing flashy, but, you know, move the sticks kind of yards real consistently, that it would worry me. And it became clear down the stretch that the only thing UTSA was going to be able to do in the run game was Frank Harris, and U of H could really just pin their ears, you know, back and go after Frank Harris. And I think you saw the Roadrunner offense not come to a complete halt. You know, they still were able to get the game to overtime, still were able to extend it to three overtimes before the Cougars prevailed. But I think you kind of saw the positive effect of having a really good veteran defensive front and made UTSA a little bit more dimensional than they wanted to be. And I think provided a good margin, a game that just was of the finest margins just generally.
Yeah. On the balance, I think you have to call it a really strong defensive performance. You mentioned the success in the run game. And even though, you know, it felt like Frank Harris was able to do some things in the pass game, you know, holding him under 7.5 yards attempt, recording 3 sacks against a veteran O-line, even with Harris showing some extremely frustrating mobility and elusiveness at times in this game, and it felt like U of H should have had him down. But, you know, all in all, I think you have to call it a pretty strong defensive performance, even though the middle two quarters, you know, got a little bit rough there. You know, UTSA's up-tempo offense gave Houston some trouble in those middle quarters. That's something that Doug Belk, I think, is going to be thinking about after this week. You know, and it's, you know, I'd say, but UTSA on a couple of occasions had a player take a comfortable seat when Houston started speeding up a little bit, and then miraculously the player would pop up as soon as they got the injury timeout. And, you know, I don't love using that as a strategy, but, you know, if the other team is having a lot of success running tempo and, you know, and you offensively, and, you know, if they are also using the fake injury, I don't know, maybe that is something to consider. Like, it's, I don't like advocating for that, but it may be something to think about. But either way, you know,
our friend Ryneko Cougs posted a really just fantastic clip of UTSA defensive lineman Joe Evans just like getting to around like the yard line number and just like plopping on the ground, and it's like, okay, man, you're definitely hurt. I could definitely tell this is a real legitimate injury, not you buying your defense a few minutes of breathing time. Yeah, sure, man.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, it was obviously even within this stadium, and I feel bad, but you know you heard some of the U of H crowd grousing at some of the during that 10.5 minute drive or whatever it was. There were 4 different UTSA injury timeouts, and one of them the guy looked legitimately shaken up. At least 2 of the other ones was just like, come on, that's, you don't seem like you're that seemed awfully convenient. It sure looked like you just kind of took a seat and then, oh, there the whistle, cool, I'm okay. So
you're in a dome, the weather's not that bad, sorry,
right? You're not cramping that hard.
Yeah.
But no, I just, yeah, and it was, and again, like you said, it was you know, you saw, despite the fact that when the you know, UTSA went tempo, and that's kind of what you worry about, is you get your, you know, defensive front just kind of a little bit worn out when you're running tempo and you're not getting pressure on the quarterback, and all of a sudden, you know, Frank Harris has got a, you know, long, clean pocket to throw out of against a, you know, U of H secondary that, you know, got some new guys taking on bigger roles. And I thought, you know, looked a lot more comfortable. I thought the secondary looked a lot more comfortable down the stretch, was starting to get, you know, more up in receivers' grills and you know, sticking with guys better down the stretch than they were early on as well. So I think that might be, you know, an instance of, like I said, some guys that had, you know, had significant roles on the team last year but weren't being asked to do as much for as many plays last year as they are this year. But, you know, all in all, you know, I think it's, like I said, not a A-plus defensive performance, but probably a solid maybe B-plus defensive performance from Doug Belk's squad. And unfortunately, the offense finally got going enough that it was enough to be a winning performance.
In a lot of ways, I think this was a really good stress test for both your defensive front and your secondary. You know, your defensive front going against a veteran offensive line, a really veteran, slippery quarterback who I think tested this group in a way that I'm not sure anyone else who's a quarterback, you know, on one of the teams in the regular season schedule will, in terms of escapability and being able to extend the play and make stuff happen with his feet. I mean, there were times where it felt like a Cougar defender was a split second late getting to Harris, and he was able to just find his man, and plenty of other times where he had multiple Cougar defenders in his vicinity, and you're like, no way he's escaping that, and he would find a way to the sideline. You're like, oh, he's going to find the open man, or he's going to find 6 or 7 yards and set up, you know, either get the first down or set up an easy third and short. You know, but I think, importantly, as the game wore on, you saw the Cougars have, you know, that better success we mentioned, getting pressure on Harris, gumming up the works in the Roadrunner offense generally. And obviously that secondary with multiple new starting cornerbacks was tested by that very veteran Roadrunner passing attack that we were concerned about coming in. It was really, I think they were everything they were advertised to be and then some. This was the matchup that scared me more than any other going up against UTSA. And so I don't think anyone should be terribly surprised that Frank Harris had 3 touchdown passes. Frank Harris had 300 plus yards, and that this was an area where, you know, maybe the Cougar defense struggled the most in week one. I would say generally the tackling at times in the open field wasn't the best, though. Remembering back to last year's week one, I thought U of H against Texas Tech struggled with open field tackling more than any other week previously, and that group ended up being, I think, one of the better tackling defenses we've seen from this program. So I don't know, maybe naive optimism on my part, and this ends up being a recurring problem, but I'm not ready to ascribe some of the, you know, missed open field tackles we saw on Saturday to anything other than week one and early season rust. And I'm saving this to the end because I don't like, and I actually thought this was what you were going to do earlier, complain about officiating, because this drove me nuts, because I thought the game's crew did a pretty bad job of calling, or I guess not calling, holding. And it's so weird because it felt like they were trying to establish something at the start. You know, they called Patrick Paul on U of H's first offensive series. And I saw that in real time. I thought that was probably the right call. They called it later in the first on UTSA's Venli Tatufu, and they called it, I think, one more time in UTSA around the middle of the second quarter. And then they didn't call it again in the third quarter, fourth quarter, and three overtime periods. Like, you're telling me no holding happened after that at all. And I think just on the face of it, that would, you know, stretch credulity. But it definitely stretched credulity when we saw Derek Parrish get tackled on at least one occasion by UTSA offensive lineman. Just laughable no calls there. And, you know, frankly, if you're UTSA and the crew's not calling it, why shouldn't you tackle Derek Parrish? It works. It's very effective. And for some reason, this crew's decided that after the third quarter, everything goes. And I'm, you know, generally somebody who would like officials calling fewer than more penalties. But, you know, I just, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't track at all to me. It just insults my intelligence as someone who follows football that guys who are more tired would be holding less. It's the opposite. Guys are going to be holding more. Guys are definitely, you know, offensive linemen going to be struggling more to block effectively without holding, and just nope, and just kind of let UTSA get away with murder on some pretty key plays there. So I'll stop complaining about this. I guess let you complain about this if you want to, but I'd like to think more officials than not this season will flag an offensive player who chooses to tackle a U of H pass rusher. But I don't know, maybe I'm being naive and optimistic again.
Yeah, no, I would say there's only two calls in this game that really kill me. And I think if I could erase two calls from my memory in terms of the officiating, I would actually have been really impressed with the officiating.
I probably didn't mention the worst one, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, the thing I liked, I'll give them the running compliment here, is I think there's only like one pass interference that was called in this game. It was a real obvious one when, you know, Golden was downfield and the guy didn't turn around and just ran him over, basically, and you had to call it. But there was a lot of other plays both ways, I thought, where the corners, you know, were playing some handsy coverage, and they just decided they weren't going to call it. And they didn't call it either way. They didn't, you know, just pick a random time or two to just call a close one. They consistently let them play. And I think that's good. But, you know, the only, you know, in there in the stadium, the one holding call that I had to mention is on UTSA's quick little, you know, rushing downfield to get the field goal right at the end of regulation. One of their two pass attempts, yeah, Derek Parrish just got dragged, the left tackle just absolutely grabbed his jersey and just dragged him to the ground. And it was right. It wasn't like some interior play. It was right out absolutely in front of the officials. It's not a play he didn't see. It's a play he saw the guy get dragged to the ground and just said, well, it's late in the game. I'm not going to upset the home crowd by like throwing a flag on this. So it's just, which is disappointing, but no, I mean, the call that you got to talk about though is Tank Dell's punt return touchdown in the first quarter coming off the board for just absolutely no reason. Just the most ridiculous, laughable, non-blocked in the back, you know, block in the back call that you'll ever see. Dana Holgorsen after the game called it one of the worst calls he's ever seen in his career. Said he didn't care if he got fined, which he probably, that's probably a good way to get fined is by calling a call the worst call that you've ever seen in your career. So I imagine somebody's going to take him up on that, not caring if he got fined thing. But that was just disappointing, and it's disappointing to, you know, kill Houston's, you know, momentum that they had earned at that point, and to, you know, take what should have been, you know, again, one of the highlights of the season, and just an unbelievable, one of the better punt returns you will ever see. Just remarkable, remarkable run by Tank Dell, and just taking off the board is a damn shame. And to take it off the board for a call that was just complete and utter nonsense is more disappointing. But, you know, it is the lamest thing you can do is come on here and complain about officiating. And like I said, apart from those two calls, I think there was actually a lot to like about with the way the crew called the game, but those two just did stand out as like, come on, like what are we doing here?
Also, I wanted to shout out while we're talking about the Cougar defense, didn't record any sacks, but DeAnthony Jones, definitely, you know, really critical defensive player, was relentless. I would argue has had in that game as positive an impact as any Cougar defensive player in keeping the team in this one, in getting pressure on Frank Harris-Lade. And would also shout out Bubba Baxa, who I mentioned earlier, I think nailed both of his field goal attempts in very big moments. You would expect a Division I kicker to hit two attempts inside of 40 yards, but, you know, good to see it happen for somebody who hadn't had a place kick in a Division I game since his sophomore year at Miami in 2019, one pandemic ago. So good to see him coming through in a big spot there. I don't have a whole lot else in terms of thoughts about this game, Dustin. I mean, bottom line, you did see some flaws. You saw some areas that needed work, but I think that's a good thing. And I don't want to pick on our future league very much, but what if U of H had done what a majority of the Big 12 did this week and scheduled an FCS opponent or just a very bottom rung FBS kind of team? We wouldn't be on here talking about how the O-line and run game need to improve or how U of H struggled at times with a veteran mobile opposing quarterback who's a rushing threat. It would have been an easy several score win. And I think we would know precisely as much about that team now as we did before the season. And, you know, we saw by no means this U of H team play a perfect game, but you saw them take the best punch of an opponent who would have gotten their first ever top 25 win in front of a rabid home crowd, a team and fan base that so desperately wanted this win, and to go out of there and still get the win, to, you know, take every punch they had and still go back on I-10 as winners. I think you can acknowledge the flaws of Saturday's performance, and that's fine. I think we've done plenty of it here, but it took a lot of guts for this team to come back and win that football game. This really looked like a team that was used to winning, a team that just refused to go back to Houston with a loss. And it sounds cliche, and I usually hate cliches like this, but it was a culture win. It wasn't a perfect win, but it was a bunch of guys down two scores saying, we're not going to let this opponent beat us. We're not going to let them, you know, let this be their signature win. We're going to come back and win this because we're one of the best programs in the state of Texas in the country. And I'm really also just happy both schools made this game happen to it. I think, you know, I alluded to it. A lot of the Big 12 schools played lousy games, and that doesn't seem very fun to talk about. It doesn't seem very fun to come back and talk about, oh, great, we beat, you know, South. Sorry to pick on your second school here, but we beat Southeast Missouri by 5 touchdowns. Great. Like, what do we really know about this team? And I think we know a lot about this Cougar team. We know some flaws of this team. We know some areas that need work, but I think we learned a lot about this team, and I think treated the college football world to a good game, and that's pretty awesome.
Hey, I am totally buying Hunter Decker's stock as a result of the Southeast Missouri State game. So
entirely fine.
I don't know what you're talking about, but no. Yeah, I think good way to end it there, other than, of course, Sam, to move on to the absolute best part of Cougar football season, forward reviews.
Hey.
We were prompted. We know y'all weren't going to let us forget to do forward reviews, but I appreciate y'all coming in clutch as always. Had lots and lots of contributions on this one. Our friend Ryan, who I got to watch a majority of the game with, asked, anyone know a cardiologist? We had Nate thinking similarly, saying, where send cardiologist Bill? Sean, concerned about the offensive line, as a number of us were, offensive line evergreen issue, he said. And the Rev CHS, keeping focusing on the positives, saying, beat a good team.
Y'all, I've also had obviously some Clayton Toon themed forward reviews, as he was probably the Cougars' best player and certainly had a incredible play there. At the end, our friend Danco Cougs had Texas Tornado called game. The guy who I believe actually prompted us to do this, us and Shazeb D, had Toon dives to survive. Nick had Toon, Dell save day, and Nose underscore God had when QBs fly. Did it in three words. Didn't even need the fourth one there.
Very nice. Tim had let Clayton Toon cook as well, and Renee was impressed with that Manjack catch, asking, Manjack equal Odell Beckham? And then UH Cougar 308, Cougar football and acrobatics, pointing with some of the screenshots to some of the remarkable catches by Manjack and others, as well as Clayton Toon's flip there.
I think I just have a couple more that you have not mentioned already. Our friend Amir had, why play but four? Yes, Amir, why play but four? But for all of our future cardiologist bills. And my personal favorite, Quentin had, meep meep, question mark, weep weep. Anytime you get a good meep meep pun in there, as that's, I think, that's my winner. You win nothing, Quentin, I'm sorry, but other than my admiration.
Very well done. We'll go ahead and end it there. And then Sam, putting the Cougs in the rearview mirror, they were not the certainly only team playing football in week one. Lots of other action going on. Maybe the craziest, most exciting game of week one. And I actually had I've had a couple an aunt and a partner's mother reach out and say, yeah, that was definitely the wildest game of all the games I watched, and week one was you guys' game. But lots of other games to talk about, and yeah, not a banner week for the American Athletic Conference, Sam, which went just 4-7 overall, with one of those wins and one of those losses coming to an FCS opponent, which isn't great. But, you know, if you kind of turn your head forward and look at our future conference, you know, you can pick on the strength of schedule, certainly, but the future Big 12 went 10-2 with both of those losses coming in one score games to top 20 teams on the road. So might not have, beaten a ton of good teams other than Houston, I guess, certainly did, but no bad embarrassing losses, if nothing else, for the future conference in week one. But let's go ahead and jump into it, and Sam, and kind of go through the week, which started on Thursday, UCF having no trouble taking care of South Carolina State. But obviously, the big game from the Future Conference and for college football as a whole was the Backyard Brawl, a just absolute banger that lived up to the hype around it for sure, and saw Pitt pulling away 38-31 at the end. So, kind of a game where early on, it looked like Pitt's offense, the highly touted offense was going to stall, but certainly, I thought looked the part in the second half, and, four second half touchdowns and getting the victory.
You want to talk about inflection points? West Virginia in this one, up 31-24, near midfield. They're really just killing Pitt on the ground at this point. They have a converted tight end. I think his name is Donaldson, running back. I think he was literally getting double digits per carry. The guy was just absolutely gashing Pitt in the middle. West Virginia has a fourth and less than one near midfield. Neil Brown decides, no, I think I'm going to punt it here. Pitt gets the ball back, promptly scores. West Virginia throws a pick six, which goes just perfectly off their best receiver's hands into the grateful clutches of a Pitt linebacker, I believe. He runs it back for a score. And all of a sudden, that 31-24 lead becomes a 38-31 deficit. West Virginia does a pretty poor job of managing their final possession, and Pitt leaves the first Backyard Brawl in 11 years as a winner. And, I don't think losing this by a touchdown is necessarily terrible. From just, you take out the context, you take out the emotion, which you can't really in college football, but just starting here, losing this by a touchdown to this Pitt team at their play is not necessarily the worst thing, but losing it when you very much had the game in the bag and really only didn't win this game because of your head coach's cowardice, a head coach that many a West Virginia fan have assured me online could just coach circles around Dana Holgorsen, is too big of a fucking idiot to know that you go for it and fourth and won that situation in your fourth year in the hot seat. I'll let out the swears, I promise, Dustin.
All right.
It's just it's crazy to me. You're on the hot seat, man. Go for it. No one's going to be like, I wish Neil Brown had played that a bit more conservative. No, nobody.
You're on the road against the top 20 team. Play to win.
Play to win in the first Backyard Brawl in over a decade. Genius, Mr. More Brilliant Than Dana Holgorsen football coach, Mr. is going to make West Virginia competitive in this league. Go, get out of here. I feel passionate about this, if you can tell.
I couldn't tell. You're playing it so cool. Houston's the other future conference foe to play on Thursday night, Oklahoma State, with the big 58-44 win over Central Michigan. And, I'm a little bit concerned about the 44 points, although a lot of that was kind of garbage time to the Chippewas. But I guess the most important thing is Oklahoma State didn't repeat the, 2016 season opening, shocking last second upset loss to Central Michigan. So they got the win. And like I said, they looked well in control of this, but if I'm an Oklahoma State fan, I'm maybe a little worried about that defense that gave up 44 points.
Yeah. I don't think at this point. I think it could very easily just be a game we look back on oh, that was weird. Oklahoma State probably has a fine defense and just oh, that was weird when they get 44 points in week one. Although of course, I guess I can't entirely rule out that's foreshadowing something a bit worse there as they try to figure out life after their awesome defensive coordinator, Jim Knowles, who's now at Ohio State.
Any other Thursday games that we need to talk about, Sam? I think that was pretty much all of them, really.
No, I can't. Penn State won a dramatic one over Purdue, and I watched a minute and a half of it while I was folding clothes, and I couldn't be bothered to say anything else about it. I just could not care less.
Big Ten football, feel the excitement.
Exactly.
Friday saw another American Athletic Conference team kick their season off as Temple lost 30-0 to Duke. And this is a game that, I think I even said it in our last episode that it was it went from a 7 to a 9 point line that Duke was favored by. I'm just is that really the numbers, a single digit number for this Temple team? Looks like dog doo-doo. I don't think they're very good. And I continue to think that they're not very good, Sam, because they basically did nothing right in getting shut out by probably the 13th or 14th best ACC team.
You certainly don't, but I'm just going to set you up. Do you know when the last time Duke shut out an FBS or 1A team was?
I have no idea.
1989. They're coaching 1989, okay. And this is how long ago this was. Steve Spurrier, noted Duke coach Steve Spurrier. That was the last time Duke shut out a FBS or 1A opponent. This is going to be a really bad Temple team. I don't think they're going to win anything other than their FCS week. And I don't know, maybe they'll make that FCS week interesting. I just wonder if you gave him truth serum, if Stan Drayton wish he was still the running backs coach at UT right now.
Yeah, maybe he has realized the scope of the rebuild job that he's gotten himself into. But yeah, you know, and I imagine you'd hope that certainly the administration there is going to give him a couple of years before they're really expecting to see any serious results. But yeah, that is a rebuild job for sure. Talking about new coaches, one that had a little bit more success from Houston's Future Conference, TCU, life in the post-Gary Patterson era off to a pretty strong start as they finished strong with 31 points in the second half to pick up a 38-13 win at Colorado. Sam, you buying TCU stock already based on this one game?
No, I think Colorado is pretty bad. But, I mean, I'm not trying to take away from TCU going in. You know, going in there, beating any, you know, quote-unquote power conference opponent by 25 and your coaches – first ever game there. I don't think anyone from TCU should, you know, take any serious criticism of the team from this game, but I don't know, man. This was a lot closer than a 25-point game for a good chunk of it, and TCU didn't really look dynamic offensively in the way that you maybe would normally expect a Sonny Dykes team to do, but yeah, I don't know. Can't pick too many nits with a 25-point road win, but I don't think you also saw any reason to think they're going to be anything more than like a 6-8-ish win team.
And but certainly I think the game of the night on Friday night has to be Virginia Tech at Old Dominion as the Monarchs pull off the 20-17 upset. I think it was their second ever win over a Power 5 team, and both of them were over Virginia Tech, I think was the factor that I saw, which, you know, man, if you're Virginia, and again, like, I don't want to say, hey, why do you schedule those games? Because like, it's great. You totally should. I wish more Power Conference teams would schedule road games against regional G5 opponents. I think the sport is better when those games happen, and credit to the ACC that the ACC has scheduled more of those games than any other Power 5, conference. But, you know, that's kind of why, as a, you know, it's probably not in your individual school's best interest to schedule those games. That's because you see things like this, Old Dominion, you know, back and forth game, and then was able to march down the field and punch it in with about 33 seconds remaining for the other winning touchdown, got the 20-17 victory. So yeah, again, I don't know why Virginia Tech scheduled that game, but I'm glad they did, and I'm sure Old Dominion is as well.
Virginia Tech's quarterback Grant Wells led FBS from regular starting quarterbacks last year at Marshall in interceptions. Dustin, 4 interceptions this one might be a problem for Mr. Wells that Virginia Tech needs to work out.
Sure seems like it. And then getting into Saturday, kind of alluded to it up top, but looking at that 11 o'clock slate, man, if you were wondering whether or not the Navy offense was going to get going under Ty Labatai this year, Sam, a 14-7 loss to FCS opponent Delaware to open the season, probably not the data point that the midshipmen were hoping for.
I don't know if you saw this. Did you see, like, Niumatalolo called this, like, oh, this is my most athletic, or he gave some kind of really just, like, eye-opening, just like, oh, yeah, it's my most athletic team. It's just like, my man, do you realize you had in the last 7 years Keenan Reynolds and Malcolm Perry, like two actually dynamic players and guys who certainly would have been held to 7 against the Delaware Blue Hens, with all respect to, I think, a pretty storied FCS program there. The fact that Navy, it's so far beyond, I think, red flags for this coaching staff. And I almost would go so far as to say red flags to this coaching staff and red flags with, do we want to continue getting our brains beat in the American Athletic Conference? Just, I feel like they're really in a bad spot right now. Like, that's, you know, you go into a season with a lot of unknown with Navy. And I think when we previewed them a couple weeks ago, we were kind of just like, you know, not really a lot of really promising signs, but you never know with Navy. There absolutely could be just like a fullback or slot back, or this could be the year that it really all clicks for Ty Labatai running the flexbone the same way that it did for Malcolm Perry previously. But ooh, buddy, this looks like a team that might give Temple their best shot at an FBS one. I know that Navy flexible is going to catch someone off guard. I know it's an equalizer, but they just look really short on anything close to dynamic offensively that, you know, could really stress the team in the way that we were so used to the flexible stressing us on a year in, year out basis. And I don't know, Dustin, these could be famous last words, but Navy week used to be a week that really concerned me. And now it's just like, I hope they don't chop block a defensive lineman's knees when we're up by 3 touchdowns. I'm sorry if that sounds arrogant. That's how far that program fell. And that's not any arrogance on my part. That's just Navy being a considerably worse team than the one we first started seeing in this conference 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, when you're opening to Delaware, I think you got bigger issues than whether or not you should still be in the American Athletic Conference or not. I think the bigger issue you've got is whether determining whether or not Ken Niumatalolo should still be your coach or not. And then, Sam, you know, 2 games I'm just going to mention back-to-back for the absolute hilarious, you know, juxtaposition of it all. But if you want to know, like, why should you love college football, what's great about college football, 2 games that I believe are both in the 11 o'clock hour in this one, App State scoring 40 points in the fourth quarter and still losing 63-61 to North Carolina, and Iowa having a field goal and two safeties and beating South Dakota State 7-3. Those are both games that are the same sport that got played, where UNC and App State scored more collective points than their basketball teams did when they faced each other last year. And I didn't look it up, but I think South Dakota State and Iowa might have scored fewer points than their baseball team scored runs whenever they played each other last. I'm not sure, but it's the beautiful mess that is college football, and it's good. I don't think if you can appreciate both of those results, then I think you're doing college football wrong.
So I was watching the game with a friend of the show, Colin Sherwin, and it was like, I think within 10 minutes you had the last Iowa safety that brought their score to 7. That's, again, worth reiterating, that 7-3 score was not because Iowa got a touchdown. It's because Iowa got a field goal and two safeties. That is the most Iowa stuff that I could possibly imagine. That we saw that, them getting their last safety, and UNC doing an incredibly ill-advised up man on an onside kick, running the ball in for a touchdown, which actually gave App State one last shot at the end zone, which they took and got and just only didn't win that game by virtue of or stay in that game by virtue of knocking the 2-point conversion at the end. I just, that North Carolina law, Dustin, that forces that public schools in the state to intermittently play each other regardless of conference affiliation, just one of the best laws this country has done in the last couple of decades, because you got that insane both teams in the 60s App State UNC game. You also got a really competitive ECU NC State game, which ended in just about the most painful way possible if you're a Pirate fan, with Owen Daffer, who I think it was an all-conference kicker for them last year, missing a well-within-his-range field goal and then missing a PAT that would have tied it and then missing a well-within-his-range field goal as time expired in a 21-20 Pirate loss. I mean, I guess it's a good sign that ECU is back to being the kind of team that's not getting their butts kicked by the UNC and NC State, that they really went in there and gave what's supposed to be a good NC State team a really tough test. But, oh man, there's just not a lot more painful ways to lose a game than the way ECU did.
Yeah, it's good to see 51,000 plus rocking Dowdy Ficklin Stadium again and having enough of an ECU team to believe in that they actually want to come out and show up to those games and those kind of numbers. And that's just, this conference is more fun. College football is more fun when ECU is hosting ACC teams and just putting on a crazy atmosphere. But yeah, that is, it's hard to imagine being in that. And that's, I guess it is. It's just, imagine if, UTSA had come down and won the game after that ridiculous last second field goal. That would probably be exactly how ECU, pretty good equivalent for how ECU is feeling right now. But that's pretty rough. That's the heartbreak of college football for sure.
It's hard to find the silver lining if you're a ECU fan. Like, oh, we're competitive with NC State again. Yeah, but it ended that way. I can't imagine anyone's feeling like too chipper right now about that.
Yeah, another team going to be trying to maybe be having a little bit of an easier time trying to take some silver linings from a loss. Cincinnati losing 31-24 on the road to number 19 Arkansas. And yeah, we kind of said it in the preview that I thought that if Cincinnati was able to really keep it within a score of Arkansas on the road, that would be a pretty strong endorsement of where they're at. And I stick by that. And certainly, I don't imagine Luke Fickell is going to be, patting his guys in the back for a moral victory of only losing by 7 to Arkansas. But, in terms of their competitiveness within the American Athletic Conference, okay, sure, they're not going to the playoff this year. I think we kind of knew Cincinnati wasn't going to the playoff this year. They're not going to repeat that feat. But in terms of what's a more realistic goal for them this year, in terms of can they be competitive at the top of the American, can they be, maybe a team that at least goes back to the conference championship game? I didn't see anything from this game which was competitive. Neither team really making a huge dent either way. Arkansas leading for much of it, but Cincinnati, never really getting out of arm's length and being right there at the end. Nothing I saw from this game made me think, oh yeah, Cincinnati's not going to be right there with, Houston and UCF and maybe SMU for the AAC title this year.
And you're not used to seeing Cincy give up 200 plus yards rushing, which they did in this one, but I don't think they will be challenged on their AAC schedule the same way as this Arkansas team. And that's, with all respect to present company here, our Cougars, but I think Arkansas is a very good top 25 team, a team that's going to be very tough to beat, even by the sport's best at their place. So I don't think any shame in the performance Cincinnati had there. I think the only thing you watch if you're Cincinnati is, okay, we were going against an SEC defensive front, make sure, hey, we're not struggling to run the ball, yeah, once it comes to maybe a bit more manageable competition. But yeah, like you, I don't think I saw anything to make me believe since he won't be among the very best in this league. If they're not at last year and the year before's insane level, fine. Like no team can have that kind of run. I still think this is going to be a very good team when it's all said and done this year.
And then, yeah, moving into some of the other afternoon games, had Georgia just absolutely beating the doors off of Oregon. I think we knew Georgia was the heavy favorite of that game for a reason, even though Oregon was number 11. But, man, there might be as big a gap between, some of the top couple of teams in the sport and everybody else, as everyone has said that there is. And that certainly is a result that makes you think so.
But just imagine, Dustin, traveling from, like, somewhere on the West Coast out to Atlanta to watch your team be turned into a fine powder by Georgia. I would definitely be questioning some things, although I would question your wisdom in the first place if you flew all that way and did not expect Georgia to turn you into a fine powder as an Oregon fan.
Yeah, and a couple more AAC losses. Tulsa goes on the road, just real nip-tuck game at Wyoming, ends up losing in double overtime to a Wyoming team that just got pantsed by Illinois in week zero. And then South Florida loses 50-21 to BYU, a game that was significantly less close even than that final score makes it sound. Tulsa team that I think had some reasonable expectations, the South Florida team was hoping to finally see some things get going under Jeff Scott, and definitely not the season opener either of those programs were hoping for.
Yeah, BYU is a good program, but being down 35-0 in the first quarter, I think you don't want to make any rash decisions based on one game. But if you're a USF fan right now saying, yeah, I don't think I've seen anything to indicate this guy will ever get this team close to being reasonably competitive in the AAC again, I can't really talk against 1-19 against FBS competition, which Jeff Scott is as of right now.
And then the only other two games, I was going to mention some of the later in the day games from the American Athletic Conference. Two teams that, I think not long ago, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, were probably right neck and neck for kind of the, upper middle tier of the conference, that now look like two teams very much heading in different directions, and that is Memphis and SMU. And again, they're both on the road, and certainly one was, on the road against an SEC team and one was on the road against, North Texas. But, Memphis looking just completely out of it, basically from the word go, against Mississippi State, ended up losing 49-23. And then SMU just absolutely, from the word go, pretty much just running away and hiding from North Texas, getting a 48-10 win over a team that had a nice win over UTEP in the Sun Bowl in week zero. So, I think if you're an SMU fan, yeah, it's only North Texas, but that's a dominant enough performance that you got to be feeling pretty good after that one. And if you're Memphis, you heard us when, we did the AAC conference preview, I think there's a lot of reasons to be concerned for Ryan Silverfield's, job performance. And certainly week one loss to an SEC team is not going to seal his fate or anything like that. But, Mississippi State not expected to be one of the, not a top 25 team, not one of the best teams in the SEC. And for Memphis to just be, to look well outclassed on that one is not the best sign.
Yeah, that was 49-23. And that 49-23, I think, was deceptive about how competitive that game actually was. It was just never close for Memphis. And for SMU, again, you don't want to overtalk North Texas, but Tanner Mordecai was nearly perfect. And, I think SMU didn't really give you, me, somebody who maybe is inclined to criticize SMU, any kind of opening or any kind of obvious weaknesses. So I was like, okay, well, they beat UNT by a lot, but they gave up a ton of yards. No, they held an offense that had looked pretty effective out in El Paso, pretty much, to nothing meaningful in any game action. I think they did anything you could ask an opponent to do against, opponent of UNT's caliber. I think they fully passed that week one test, even if, I don't think I'm ready to crown them the future AAC champions just based on beating UNT.
All right, Sam, I think that is all the games I have in my notes. Did you have any other games we need to mention?
No, my Boise State and Oregon State recommendation was total garbage. That was a bad game that Oregon State dominated a Boise State team that, I don't know, Dustin, maybe we've seen the end of Boise State just being that team we mentally pencil 10-11 wins for. That was just a very disappointing effort, even acknowledging Oregon State is a solid Pac-12 program. That's the kind of program Boise used to beat by two or three touchdowns, not get beat by two or three touchdowns by.
Yeah, you want to talk about a couple of programs that seem like they're moving in opposite directions, that Boise State team and Oregon State, definitely two programs that yeah, you'd expect this to be a comfortable Bronco victory even a few years ago. And instead it was, the Beavers jumped out to a big lead early and won that one comfortably. You made that one, you know, again, there weren't really any other games in the late time slot. That was the right pick in terms of games to watch late at night, but it just ended up being non-competitive.
Yeah, thought it would at least be a decent. I thought it would at least be competitive for a half, and it was just basically non-competitive from the word go.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for us. Look forward to being back in Houston for our next episode in a few days, when we'll be talking about all other Cougar sports. As I can definitely enunciate words here, talk about the wins over the weekend from Cougar volleyball and Cougar soccer, as well as previewing Houston's game next Saturday against Texas Tech. So we'll be excited to be talking to you again in a couple of days. So be sure to check your podcast feeds for that one. But for now, that's going to be it for us. On the way out, as always, big old thank you to the podcast Patreon supporters. Make sure to go to shpodcast.com/support if you want to put some money behind the work that Sam and I do on a weekly basis. Be sure to email us shpodcast@gmail.com. or tweet at us at SH Podcast if you want to say hi. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. 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 No cap.